morning, as it still is, Father Owen, and thank you for coming. Can I ask, first of all, if you give your full name?
Father Owen McGrail.
Right. And do we have permission to record this interview?
Yes.
Right. And for the purposes, where and when were you born?
I was born in Galway, Ireland, Portumna.
And when?
In 1935.
And how did you meet Father Paul first?
As a curate in Llanelli in 1974, he was then the parish priest of Haverford West, and he visited his family regularly in Swansea, but en route he'd called to the presbytery in Haverford West. There was Canon Schwartz and there was Father Dermody later, and I met him then. That was the first time I met him. And then we were around the same age at the time, and we became friends. We, you know, regularly he'd call in. We nearly all the time we would call in to Llanelli on his way, usually very late at night, we'd have a chat, and then we got to know him. In the years later, I was 5 years in Llanelli as a curate, so we met regularly. You know, we just go out for meals and various things. So, you know.
And what would you say is those early impressions of the man himself?
Well, he was certainly extremely gregarious. Sorry, he was you know, easy to communicate with. You know, easy to become friends with. He was, funny. He was very, 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 very witty. His remarks, you know, on descriptions of people very. He seemed to. He was jolly, but also had a serious points. He was clearly interested in people and their welfare. You know, he wasn't prayerful as we would expect a priest to be, but he was always interested in the welfare of people and especially those unfortunate, you know, the waifs and the strays of this world, and always a compassion. There was a compassion about him, about those who were less fortunate than he was, even though he himself came from a fairly, upper middle class background.
Before this interview started, you were telling us some of your favourite stories. Benefit of the recording,
The favourite stories, the favourite recollections I have was him during his 3 months in Singleton and Sancta Maria, you know, facing a terminal illness. And this is where his character seemed to come to the fore. His approach to his terminal illness was very positive, he could still retain his sense of humour, during those times, he would recall some of incidents. But as I've been mentioning to you, the incidents that relate to his period as parish priest, that he would recall to us, you know, these were the funny ones, really. The one which I, mentioned in the Mass about the time that Bishop Fox was visiting the parish, and he always visited the sick, and he took Father Paul with him. To visit the sick and do the blessings. And Paul came back then. He came back after a very, very lengthy and, hard-working afternoon by the whole sick of the parish. Bishop Fox said to him, Paul, thanks be to God, that's over now, he said, it's not over yet, he said. And he said, oh, dear, you have to visit the Labour Club, he said. Oh, really, he said. Do I have to? Yes, he says, my lord, he said, because I bet £10 I'd bring you in. And to give him credit, Bishop Fox came into the Labour Club in all his regalia, you know, and had a pint with the boys. That's, you know, a familiar one.
The gardening story.
Oh, the gardening story. Yes, he was, as you know, Paul was very, very interested in the needs of the underprivileged, and as at every presbytery, these people came to the door. I mean, we all know what happens. You know, it's their final refuge, and they expect the priest to help them, economically, and give them. Now, there's the one case where where this chap came to the door, and he wanted, he told him this cock and bull story about his uncle being dead in Ireland, and he wanted the fare to fish from Fishguard, fare to Ireland. And he put up this famous story, and Paul gave him quite a considerable amount of money to cover the fare. So, okay, he went off. Later on, Paul, as he usually did, visited the Labour Club, just an hour before closing, usually. And who do you think was at the bar, absolutely stocious drunk, that the fellow he gave the fare to Ireland to? So Paul was so furious, that he, nearly sort of, well, he had to be prevented from physically. And he said, this is the fare to Ireland was spent, drinking the afternoon. That's the sort of story, but that didn't stop him, doing.
But you said there was a break in the presbytery, and he ended up going to defend.
That's right. That's another case. It's typical. I'm trying to bring out the point that he had a great heart, and he still was human. He could sometimes. And the break into the presbytery is a well known story where this chap broke in, and then I hope I'm accurate in this, but I know not only did he take things, but he threw things out of the window, clothes of his that he was to come later on. I don't know. So anyway, the police were called, and the police indicted him for this. And there was the magistrate's court, and Paul went down to the magistrate's court and defended him in front of the magistrates, claiming that, maybe he needed things more than he did, etc. That was one case I can note, but that was a regular case, that he would defend people who were not just breaking into the presbytery, in any particular position whom he'd have known. He regularly appeared at the magistrates' courts defending people.
Yeah.
And so that's, these are typical, these are stories which bring out his humanity and his sense of recognizing the needs of people, and therefore the backgrounds, which we all, could be responsible for their behaviour, you don't know.
And the background that was quite different
to his own background, which was upper middle class, really.
Yeah. Yeah.
But he had tremendous consciousness of the needs of the unfortunate and the underprivileged.
Yeah. Yeah.
And again, it also applied to the sick, because where the sick were concerned, they were a top priority to him,
Yeah.
And of course ended up with his notion of a hospice, because he realized that at that particular time, and that historically hospices were rare institutions, and he had this idea that there should be a place. I think that the original plan came because of a housekeeper called Mrs. Dursley, whom I didn't know. And when she got very ill and at the end there was no place she could go, I have an idea that was the actual initial reason why he thought of the hospice. You know, there should be a place where these people should be, you know, given refuge. And there wasn't anyone locally, you know.
And you said, first of all, he was interested in, with the generosity of his aunt in Jersey,
yes,
interested in the house, first
that's
of all.
Right, then. His initial point was to have a residential hospice. I think I mentioned that in my talk. And that was initially, and he wanted a large property, you know, and he had his eyes on certain properties in the Amford West area, you know. So that was his initial.
Yeah.
So, as obviously during his illness, he did mention regularly in my talk visits, you know, the hospice, but naturally he was more interested then in his own spiritual future, you know. I mean, he didn't mention it that often, you know, towards the end.
Yeah.
He did mention many times, you know, that he hoped that project would continue after him, you know.
Yeah.
And it was later on, as we know, that the committee had to decide on hospice at home, and to make what part he would play, you know, if God had given him the help. I suppose he would certainly go along with the project as because he would take the advice of the bishop, you know, and which I had to take,
And you said, as regards that you came off the initial.
That's right. I mean,
so that it would be a more.
That's right.
Decided,
that's an important point, really. I mean, at the beginning, you know, there was the talk of it. I mean, Michael Burke and Russ and Mike Salvo and those, we got together. I mean, we just talked, you know, about now continuing his legacy, and we talked about it and what we're doing, what sort of thing. And so, and I obviously, since it involved the parish, I would have to communicate that to the bishop. You see, this is now, we had not actually created. We just talked together. I think I don't know where we met, the presbytery. We agreed, you know, that obviously, you know, a thing like that run by the parish would have to get the consent of the bishop. And I, as far as I know, I think we had a meeting with Bishop Fox, and he mentioned to me, it was already an idea that I had in mind, that it was a big thing to undertake. And he then brought the point up. He said that the idea was good, and he was all for it, but he said it should not from the beginning be a Catholic thing or a parish thing, because it's too big for a parish to undertake that, and especially ecumenical involvement, he said, you know, was brought up. And he said, and this small little group that we had agreed that this was the only way they could do it. But he also said to me then, he said it would be an idea that while I'd be part of the working, but officially I should not be on the committee, but he said that would stop you, you know, encouraging them and supporting them, and then the official committee set up. I was not part of the official committee, and then they agreed that it would be, and then we had obviously great, you know, I was a member of the ecumenical group, you know, the fraternal round, and they were all the you know, including Canon Harvey, who was a great friend of Father Satori. You know, he was vicar of St. Martin's at the time. He was very supportive, and he became, you know, very, very supportive. And they, it set off then with the initial committee. I'm not even sure. I know some of them, obviously, and they set up the committee then, which put the whole thing in motion and got you know, charitable status and various things like that. So I'm pretty certain that Paul would agree to that too, you know, that, and I'm sure that Bishop Fox would have brought the same point up, you know. So, yeah.
Can I ask you to recount what you said, which I found interesting, when he was in Whittybush and the diagnosis was that the bishop had been told and the priest that the diagnosis was terminal.
Yes.
And he had to be told that story.
That's a story which, again, he recalled to me in Singleton, and also I learned it from Canon Conan, for to mercy on him. Initially, he was in Whittybush, and consultants, you know, went through the procedures, and finally mentioned to the bishop and to Canon Conan, who was dean, that really this is very serious, and that it would be palliative care, and so it came to the point then of telling him, and he had his own particular cubicle in Whittybush. So Canon Conan then had this sad sort of job as telling him, and Seamus, you know, went in, and he said it wasn't easy for either of them, because while Seamus was, you know, a different character still, they were good friends, and so he received it, according to Seamus, without any great emotion. He just said that he would need half an hour to reflect personally on this news, and that Seamus, as he called him, would come back in half an hour, and then he'd tell him his reaction. So of course, when Seamus went back, he was in quite a different mood, and he said, "Well, if God something say says that, you know, if God wants me," he said, "I accept it," but he said, "He's got to expect a fight." So he said, "I'm not sitting under this, and I want all the treatment." And he said, I think he mentioned too, in fact, you know, the power of prayer and the prayer of the parish, and you know, that God, you know, that prayer can change things, something. So his whole treatment, you know, went from there then to Singleton, as far as I know, and on to Santa Maria. And it was his approach all the time.
Yeah.
And he went through a lot of very painful treatments, where others might say, you know, palliative care. And especially his treatment, while it was very, you know, it was painful, and especially in Singleton, you know, yeah. When I visited him so regularly, it was a heavy cross.
Yeah.
But he accepted it, you know, and at the same time accepted another story, which I might tell was that, which I often tell, is, I think I told it in the church, that towards the end of his, you know, things were getting sort of close to the time, and I visited him one evening, and his family were there, including his mother, and he said to me, I want to see you now, he said. And he said, as soon as these go, he said, to some extent, as if more or less said, clear the house, I want to see you on your own. And he said, there's certain things that we need to discuss. And he said, because he said, in a week's time, he said, I could be Dulali. He said, and I wouldn't be able to talk to anybody. So now we said, since I have all my marbles, he said, I want to see you. And now we talked on things, which of course I'm not going to elaborate on, which were close to him, and things especially, I could mention the fact, projects, things which in his, I think, probably in his work on the wider scale of looking at, of, you know, in the parish, he had neglected. And for one thing, and I need to say that, his economic and his bookkeeping was absolutely disastrous, really. He wasn't up to date at all. So he said, and certain things he wanted undone, you know. So
yeah.
Again, and I was quite willing to do. He said, you know, things will have to be done. So, and other things which he wanted to discuss, and that was very emotional. And then he I'll always remember. He was so emotional that I began to express emotion. Really, I suppose you could say I broke down. He said, "Hold on," he said, "lad," he said, "hold on," he said, "it's me that's dying, not you." You know, I mean, that's the sort of character he was. And that brought me back to reality. So I always remember that particular incident. Now, it mightn't have come in to that particular question, but these mm-hmm. things, like, they can be. But that's the sort of person he was, you know. And I must emphasize how he was a tremendous example of how to accept terminal illness,
right,
without giving up the ghost,
Yeah.
You're giving up. That's what happened. And so, yeah.
Yeah, because I think that's a new sight.
It is.
That people, other people who knew him from dealing with him as parishioners and people who came to him wouldn't have.
That's right.
Wouldn't
yeah.
have
experienced
that. So
him. Yes.
That's very important to
to
put down. It would be very difficult to ask you sort of. For you to sort of, which is one of the questions here, like in three words to sum up the man, because you've summed him up in so many so many different things you could say about him.
Well, I couldn't think of three words, but all I could emphasize is that outside, you know, he was gregarious, he was popular, he was very much a man of the people. He had a very, very deep spiritual life, and you know, he was spiritual, and he you know, he wasn't in any way, you know, he was conscious, you know, he had him, you know, he didn't sometimes have much, you know, he thought that he didn't devote sufficient of his life to the spiritual, but I think he did. And the way often it was said of him, you know, that he could be outside, you know, but when he got onto the altar to say Mass, he was a different person.
Yeah.
And that was said by many people, that once he put on those vestments and appeared on the altar, there was nothing haphazard about how he reacted. He certainly said his prayers, and he had a deep spiritual life apart behind that. So, and that's the impression I would give from you know, and he was very much a priest, and you know, he was never anything other than a priest. I as far as I could see, you know, he had the qualities of both sides. He had both sides of the coin. You know, he was a priest, spiritual, but again, he was a pastor and had a caring, very caring person.
And so underneath the outside sort of thing, there's
yeah.
a as a foundation of
absolutely. I mean, you know, there was never any doubt about the fact that, and he never moved in any way away from the image of what a priest should be.
Yeah.
But and in many ways, you could say that's the way a priest should be. I mean, the idea, you know, the old idea was the sacristy priest, you know, who said mass, said his prayer, said his office. That was not his vision, and neither should it be in a pastor, you know, sort of.
Yeah.
And that maybe is part of his, you know, when you say the vision of a hospice, his care for the you know, the ordinary person and the needs of the ordinary person in
yeah.
in a distressful situation come to the end of their lives, you know, that was part of his vision of what a priest should do. You know.
Yeah. And you said because he was so well known that when people were wanting to make funeral arrangements,
that's right, yes.
From all denominations,
that's right, yes.
or none,
yes.
would ask him to.
That's right. I mean, that was part of his. He was so well known that many people who had bereavements, you know, and wanted, well, parents or so forth, but wanted religious service. But had no commitment to a chapel or a church. Because he was so well known, they would just mention his name as someone who would help them, and he did.
Mm.
And he was, in many cases he did, you know, services, you know, especially in the crematorium,
yeah.
you know, and again, and that of course was no problem with the churches. Approach either, you know, I do it myself.
Yeah.
So, so that was his way of saying, you know, that he did not, that he wanted people, you know, to, you know, before, you know, that they should have religious service if they wanted it, and he was prepared to give it to them. And of course, the reason behind that was that of course he knew them.
That's what I was saying, that he wasn't a sacristy priest, and so when he's going out there, like everybody says today, it's lovely to hear a man up at the altar who actually knows the deceased rather than...
That's right, and who could say something about them.
Yeah.
I mean, he's understood, that, you know, and he was very communicable, you know, he had good friends among the local clergy, you know, got on very well with all the local clergy, and you know, there's a few in particular. Canon Harvey who was now retired in Tenby. He was parish priest or vicar of St. Martin's. They were good friends.
So he might be a man to speak to.
He might know, like he certainly knew him.
Yeah.
And he appeared at the masses.
Right.
He did. You know, he appeared. You know, in the congregation. So I don't know what health John is at the moment.
Do you think that we've covered a fair bit now? Is there anything else you'd like to mention?
I think we have. I mean, the point what I've been emphasizing is that he was a man of the people. He was very much a priest, but a priest with conscious of the needs of the underprivileged, and the need to help them, and that was his vision, and therefore that vision, which is now being thankfully being expressed in the foundation.
Yes.
And I think personally, you know, as I mentioned at the Mass, you know, that the Paul Sartori Foundation is probably his finest legacy, and to me, you know, and not alone, as I mentioned, are they his legacy, but he will be proud of what they are doing, and in that sense that they are keeping, you know, his vision, you know, as an inspirational leader in that line, and that's that by keeping to his vision, the Paul Sartori's success is part of it. Really, that's about, you know, that's and I'm so pleased that this what you're doing is being initiated, yes. So,
well, really grateful for you to come in and talk about it, because you have a an insight that very few people have.
Yeah, I mean, there's so much more, but I think that, you know, basically you can make